Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
For 50 years, Israel has acted with absolute impunity when it comes to its war of genocide against Palestinians. They've murdered, killed, obviously, and tortured many Palestinians. Today, we're suing because a lot of those folks have been U.S. citizens.
What do Ariel Sharon, George Bush, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, the One Israel Fund, and the Christ Lutheran Church have in common? Stanley Cohen. He's suing them all on behalf of Palestinian Americans for racketeering and war crimes. Banks plunge as Congress probes Enron ties. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase shares go into freefall as congressional investigators show how the two biggest U.S. banks help Enron hide its debts. And the Bush administration halts international family planning funds. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's facing searing international criticism after an Israeli F-16 dropped a one-ton laser-guided bomb on a densely populated neighborhood in Gaza City. The bombing killed Hamas leader as well as 9 children and 5 other civilians. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said President Bush, quote, believes the heavy-handed action does not contribute to peace. But he also said President Bush has been and will continue to be the first to defend Israel, and he didn't mention that the F-16 used in the attack was made in America. The British government called the attack unacceptable and counterproductive. British MPs condemned the government for exporting arms to Israel and forced Foreign Secretary Jack Straw to admit British military equipment may have been used in the attack. He promised to investigate. European Union diplomats said the attack came just hours before many armed Palestinian groups were expected to declare a unilateral halt to suicide attacks. There was a possibility Hamas would join. The day before the attack, the spiritual leader of Hamas said the group would consider halting suicide attacks if Israel withdrew from occupied West Bank cities. Some 100,000 Palestinians marched in the funeral procession yesterday of the 15 Palestinians killed in the attack. The crowd vowed revenge. The attack comes as Israel's deputy defense minister, Dalia Rabin-Felisoff, resigned. She's the daughter of the former prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin. Colleagues say she's upset at Sharon's reluctance to resume peace talks with the Palestinians. U.S. military investigators will travel to a village in Afghanistan later this week to try to explain why a U.S. gunship killed some 50 civilians in a bombing raid on a wedding party. U.S. investigators have begun questioning servicemen involved in the operation at a military base in Kandahar. Following a New York Times report confirming hundreds of civilians have been killed in the bombing of Afghanistan so far, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Monday the U.S. bombing campaign in Afghanistan may have resulted in fewer deaths of innocent civilians than any other air war in history. The bombing has caused a major rift in the Afghan government, with some ministers demanding to be consulted in future U.S. raids. Meanwhile, an elite U.S. force has been assigned to guard Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai amid concerns of possible assassination attempts. And at least 12 people have been killed in clashes between rival Afghan factions in the western province of Herat. The fighting between ethnic Tajiks and Pashtuns began Sunday night. FBI agents arrested Muslim activist James Ujamaa on Monday. The New York Times reporting Ujamaa worked on a British website that advertised the, quote, ultimate jihad challenge. He also runs a site called StopAmerica.org, which opposes U.S. foreign policy. Ujamaa is a social activist and writer well known in Seattle's African-American community. He's been flown to Virginia and has not been charged. FBI and prosecution officials have refused to comment on the arrest. In Florida, a federal court has ordered 2 retired Salvadoran generals to pay over $50 million in damages to 3 Salvadoran civilians who were tortured by security forces during the El Salvadoran military's reign of terror. The 3 plaintiffs gave graphic testimony of beatings, gang rapes, and other forms of torture in the early 1980s by El Salvador's military. The federal jury in West Palm Beach found that former Defense Minister Jose Guillermo Garcia and former former head of the National Guard, Carlos Vives Casanova, knew of atrocities committed by their troops and did nothing to prevent them. The two have been living in Florida since 1989. The U.S. supported and funded El Salvador's military throughout the bloody conflict that killed at least 75,000 Salvadorans. The verdict is especially significant because it's one of the very few instances since World War II in which a civilian jury has successfully held military commanders responsible for torture. The torture and killings took place during the Reagan-Bush years of the 1980s. Meanwhile, human rights groups are charging that the Bush administration is trying to sideline a new treaty to prevent torture. A draft of the optional protocol to the UN Convention Against Torture is to be considered for adoption by a key UN committee today, but Washington is instead trying to create a special working group to discuss it further. Among those backing Washington, the effort to derail the treaty, are several states on the administration's terrorism list, including Cuba, Iran, and Libya. A priest who supports gay rights and women priests has been named as the next Archbishop of Canterbury, spiritual leader of 70 million Anglicans worldwide. Rowan Williams is also critical of the U.S.-led military campaign in Afghanistan after September 11th. Last week, he signed a letter condemning any U.S. attack on Iraq. He is considered a critic of U.S. foreign policy and corporations.
Greed is a strand in the American dream. Having more than you need is a essential theme. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if...
Greed, Sweet Honey, and The Rock. I'm Amy Goodman. Congress yesterday turned its attention to the role banking giant Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase played in the Enron scandal. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase shares went into freefall as congressional investigators showed how the two biggest U.S. banks made $200 million in fees for transactions that helped Enron and other energy companies boost their cash flow and hide debt. Congressional investigators Tuesday laid out evidence that the banks were knowing participants in Enron's efforts to make its debts appear as trades through the use of prepaid energy contracts. Senior executives from both banks defended their actions, telling the congressional inquiry that, quote, prepay transactions were legitimate financing structures used widely on Wall Street. But the chair of the Subcommittee on Investigation, Senator Carl Levin, said the banks, quote, knew what Enron was doing, assisted Enron in the deceptions, and profited from their actions. We're joined by two people, Charlie Cray of CitizenWorks and Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, to talk about the latest corporate scandal and what people are doing about it. We'll begin with Charlie Cray, who's about to head out, director of the Corporate Reform Campaign at CitizenWorks. Can you explain the latest New York Times expose on what Citigroup knew and did with Enron?
Well, Amy, Citigroup essentially helped Enron construct the house of cards that collapsed very quickly, and they were deceiving both investors and the credit rating agencies such as Standard & Poor's, so that their rating went from investment grade to default very precipitously. I mean, that was the whole astonishing thing about Enron. And they did this by these dubious deals that they call prepays, where Enron accepted large advance payments, prepayments for things like natural gas or other commodities that were never really delivered. And they listed them as trade when they actually were loans constructed in a way to conceal their debt and overstate cash flow from operations. And that helped them, you know, inflate the value, make their books look good and inflate their value ultimately on the market.
Dean Baker, can you talk about the significance of these scandals at this time?
Well, what you're looking at when you have something like Enron, it'd be the same with, you know, Global Crossing, WorldCom, on down the list. You have a situation where you go, look, a lot of people were part of party to these transactions in some manner. And when you look at, you know, a bank like Citicorp, you go, well, they were dealing with Enron to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, either they had no idea what they were doing, which, you know, give them credit for innocence, but doesn't say much for their competence, or they were in on it. and it now looks like they were in on it. And what this just shows is that, you know, as deep as this has already gone in terms of the number of large corporations that have been implicated, the accounting firms, on, it's clear that the scandals go much, much deeper. This is very deeply embedded in corporate culture.
There's a front page piece in the Wall Street Journal today that says, what could bring 1930s-style reform of U.S. businesses? And it says, high-profile companies go bust, business leaders fall into disrepute, the stock market crumbles, finally the political system convulses, rewriting the rules the corporate world must follow. All that happened to the U.S. in the early 1930s when a shattered economy, a devastated stock market, and revulsion toward the business class produced sweeping changes in the way business and finance were conducted. Now America faces the possibility of a similar wave of reform. Charlie Cray, can you talk about how CitizenWorks and other groups are dealing with this and what you are demanding?
Well, CitizenWorks and other organizations are pushing for more fundamental reforms rather than, merely stronger enforcement, because the laws are not adequate. I mean, nobody's going to jail right now. Executives aren't even disgorging the amount of money that they've run off with. And in the case of the banks, Senator Levin has already indicated that he's just going to leave this up to prosecution, when actually this indicates a deeper problem, and we need a debate like they had in the 1930s over banking structure. You know, they set up the Glass-Steagall Act to separate some functions in banks, and we see that when you house separate functions such as underwriting, brokerage unit activities, analyst functions under one umbrella, you have insurmountable conflicts of interest that need to be separated out, at least.
You're protesting the secrecy with which Congress is conducting the investigations. Can you explain?
Well, this is there's actually a protest today on the Hill over the secrecy of the accounting reform negotiations that are ongoing in the conference committee between the House and the Senate. So that's kind of a distinct thing. This investigation, the Senate subcommittee investigation on the banks, just came out this week. Has been pretty good and open. If anything, people should be asking, where's Justice Department? Because there are ongoing investigations in Congress of the banks and also, I guess, the DA of Manhattan as well.
You know, it's interesting, at the same time that this is going on, the corporate scandal is rocking the nation. There's this unprecedented corporate crime wave in the country, or at least it's being paid attention to. The Justice Department announced that in dealing with the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, they were shifting their resources, taking them away from the division that investigates corporate crime and putting them into other areas. How does this affect what's going on right now and perhaps the lack of investigation that you referred to?
Well, we discovered when President Bush announced his new SWAT team, his fraud task force, that it itself appears to be a fraud, because they're not adding any budget or additional staffing to the task force. I mean, there is some interagency communication going on that you would have expected was occurring already. But, so I think the ultimate solution in this case is going to have to be strong grassroots pressure on elected officials and on the administration to get something done. I mean, we're moving from the stage of shock and disbelief into anger and rage right now in this country, and I think we're going to see more of that as people understand what's going on.
Specifically, though, what needs to be done?
Well, we need to roll back some of the deregulations that occurred over 20 years. It's a big thing, and it's a multi-level job. And we have to start by forcing Congress to get deeper campaign finance reform. We've got to get stronger enforcement tools, for the agencies like the SEC, but also for civil actions such as rolling back the shield so that people can get at the deeper pockets like the lawyers and the bankers. There was this Private Securities Litigation Reform Act in 1995 that's got to be repealed, because it essentially prohibits people from being able to sue these collaborators and colluders in this kind of fraudulent activity. And again, we need structural reform in certain areas like the banks. same way we've seen in the accounting industry, the debate. We're not even seeing a debate yet in the banking sector.
Dean Baker, you did a piece called Costs of the Stock Market Bubble. In a lot of cases over the years, when the stock market goes up and it's hailed by all the news organizations as they talk about, you know, the Dow Jones up today, that didn't help the average American. Even when the stock exchange, when the Dow Jones was up, you could have stocks go up and tens of thousands of people were laid off. What is happening with Wall Street today, and how does that affect the average American?
Well, of course, most people, about half the nation owns no stock at all, and of the half that does, most don't own very much. They own less than 20,000. So, you know, they're much more concerned about if they have a job, how much money they're getting on their job, than, you know, if the market's up 10 or 15 or 20%. But just to clarify things, there was a bubble, 98, 99, 2000. We're seeing it unravel now. The problem isn't that it's unraveling. The problem is that there was a bubble. And there's a lot of people who have a lot of apologizing to make because it was very clear there was a bubble. I argued with a lot of economists. I just go, if there's not a bubble, show me how this makes sense. Write down what the stock returns will be over the next decade. No one would take me up on that challenge because the numbers they'd have to put down would be ridiculous, and they knew it. So the fact that you had economists, policy people, brokers, analysts that were telling people to put their retirement money into the stock market for the long term, something that guaranteed you lose your shirt, those people have a lot to apologize for. So what we're seeing is, first and foremost, the correction of the bubble, and in the process, something that many of us predict, or at least some of us predicted, that we're finding a lot of these accounting abuses, a lot of fraud, because in when you have stock prices rising out of line, you have a lot of things that don't make sense, it's very easy to make up numbers and get away with it, and you have a lot of people that are quite willing to do that, apparently. So what we're seeing is the correction of a bubble that never should have been allowed to develop to begin with.
I'm looking at a piece from the very conservative National Review called Joe Lieberman's Cover-Up, and it says, given the central role played by Citigroup in concealing Enron's debt from investors, the general public, and government regulators, why hasn't former Clinton Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, now the chair of Citigroup's executive committee, been called to testify before Congress? In particular, why hasn't the chair of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, Joseph Lieberman, sought Rubin's testimony? After all, Lieberman is heading up Senate investigation into Enron's bankruptcy and fraudulent dealings. What do you think of that, Dean Baker?
Well, you have two people that have a lot to answer for. Joe Lieberman stood at the center of preventing stock options from being properly accounted back in the early 90s, and that's contributed to a lot of the abuses, both in CEO pay and deceptive accounting that we've seen over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years. So he has a lot to answer for. Robert Rubin, even before this latest round with Citibank's involvement, he was already known to have placed a call to Treasury. This is in the New York Times back about 4 or 5 months ago. He placed a call to Treasury when they first became aware that Enron was about to go under. He asked the Treasury Department, or one of the people he knew there, to intervene with the rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, to ask if they could delay the downgrading of Enron. Now, at that time, Citibank had hundreds of billions of dollars of Enron's debt. What do you think they would have done with that debt if the Treasury had done as Robert Rubin requested and gotten Standard & Poor's and Moody's to delay their downgrading? Undoubtedly, they would have sold it off to some other sucker who'd be holding debt that was suddenly worth an awful lot less. How this man has managed to maintain, you know, this stellar reputation is beyond me.
Charlie Cray, this is a piece from Reuters that says that Harvey Pitt, the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, has asked Congress for a raise and a promotion. This, according to the New York Times, Pitt had asked lawmakers in private discussions to add a provision to the corporate and accounting bill moving through Congress that would elevate his office to the same rank as cabinet posts like Secretary of State and Attorney General. The plan would have raised Pitt's status above counterparts at nearly all other government agencies and ranked him higher than the director of Central Intelligence and the head of the CIA. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know about their ranking vis-a-vis other agencies, but it's true that the SEC has had problems in terms of understaffing and high turnover of particularly professional staff. So we do support the idea that they need more resources. But on the other hand, the SEC needs to, you know, much more strongly enforce and use the tools that they have for disgorgement of ill-gotten gains from executives and other tools that they have.
And Harvey Pitt's role?
Well, Harvey Pitt is inherently conflicted. I mean, he defended many of the accounting firms that are, you know, that are at issue here. So we would support the idea that he would resign. I don't think it's the, you know, the first thing. I don't think it gets at the structural nature of the problem. But I, you know, I think he is inherently conflicted. He had to recuse himself from 29 different cases so far. You know, some of his proposals are pretty weak. He offers the idea in his speech to the National Press Club last week that if he has to resign, then, you know, you'd have someone in there who wouldn't know securities law, and that's just not the case. There are plenty of people out there who are not conflicted, who know securities law, who could be appointed to that position.
Finally, Dean Baker, there's a lot of discussion in the media now about Glass-Steagall, and it's thrown around, but I don't think a lot of people understand. We only have 60 seconds, but could you quickly explain what it was and what it means for the future?
Well, Glass-Steagall was passed in the Depression to eliminate a lot of abuses from the 20s, primarily having crossovers between banks where you go and deposit money in a checking and savings account and brokerage firms that underwrite stock issues. And the concern was money going from one to the other and putting much more risk on the bank accounts that really should be there. This was overhauled back in, I believe it's 96, removing many of the barriers, and we were assured that there would be firewalls in place to prevent abuses. I think given what we've seen already, we have serious reason to question whether those firewalls are going to hold.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Charlie Cray with CitizenWorks, both in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll be joined by a lawyer who has filed an unprecedented lawsuit, charged Ariel Sharon, George Bush, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and others for racketeering and war crimes. We'll be back in a minute. Motherless Child, Sweet Honey, and The Rock. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel is facing searing international criticism after an Israeli F-16 dropped a one-ton laser-guided bomb on a densely populated neighborhood in Gaza City. The bombing killed a Hamas leader as well as 9 children, 5 other civilians. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said President Bush, quote, believes the heavy-handed action does not contribute to peace. He also said Bush has been and will continue to be the first to defend Israel and didn't mention the F-16 used was made in America. But some people in this country are trying to hold the White House and U.S. arms manufacturers accountable. New York attorney Stanley Cohen recently filed a lawsuit against Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, President George Bush, Secretary of State General Colin Powell, a number of U.S. arms manufacturers like Boeing and McDonnell Douglas, as well as Textron and Bell Helicopter, and groups like the One Israel Fund, as well as an organization called the Christ Lutheran Church. He joins us in the studio right now. He's filed a suit on behalf of Palestinian Americans. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
now.
You for asking.
So explain this suit, charging all of these individuals, groups, corporations with racketeering and war crimes.
Well, it's essentially a very simple suit. It's been used. In fact, you earlier spoke about a successful lawsuit for U.S. citizens or resident aliens who'd been tortured by the military in El Salvador. It's very similar. We are representing a class of Palestinian Americans, U.S. citizens or resident aliens, that we expect to expand into the thousands that live or have family living in the West Bank or Gaza. They've been killed. They've been injured. They've been tortured. Their property's been destroyed. Their homes have been taken by acts carried out individually and collectively by not just the Israeli government, by companies that sell weapons to Israel knowing they're being used in violation of international law, that receive money, namely settlements from Christian and Jewish organizations in the United States, which is used to buy weapons which are used defensively against Palestinians. And the suit includes Sabra Shatila, 1982, specifically with regard to Ariel Sharon. Essentially, what we're saying is these are U.S. citizens who have been injured, whose lives have been taken, property destroyed, and we're applying U.S. law in a U.S. court in front of U.S. judges and juries, as is their right. This type of suit has been used successfully in the past against Iraq and Iran and Libya and Cuba. It has been used in other jurisdictions within the United States. There are, in fact, Israeli Americans living in Israel who are suing organizations in federal court in the United States for the converse, for acts attributed to Hamas or other groups on the ground in which they've had losses. It is very wide-ranging. It is very complex, but at the end of the day, it's very simple. Israel does not deny that these acts have occurred. Essentially, what Israel says is it's justified because, in their mind, they're acts of war. Under international law and U.S. law, they're wrong. The most glaring example is what occurred in Gaza yesterday. It's that type of impermissible act of war, of genocide, of crime against humanity, which is at the core of this particular lawsuit.
Tell us about the person who is the chief plaintiff in this.
She's a young woman, 22 years of age. On the first day of the invasion in Ramallah in this past spring, she heard some gunfire off in the distance. She and her husband and her nine-month-old child got in their car to drive to her father's home, 100 yards away or so. On the way there, they were surprised by an Israeli undercover unit, IDF forces, specialized as Shin Bet force, actually. They had no weapons. They didn't resist. They stopped immediately, and their car was peppered with over 100 rounds of automatic weapons fire. She was shot dead, hit dozens of times. She fell over on her young child. The husband was seriously shot. He was able to drag his child away to safety. Neighbors came out to help. They, too, were shot. American citizen, committed no crime, did nothing wrong, and was shot down, killed by the IDF using guns sold by the United States and under the support of military corporations in the United States that have, for example, sold Apache helicopters, that have sold F-16 jets, that have sold grenade launchers that are used repeatedly against civilians in violation of U.S. and international law.
Is this Sereda Salah?
I can't identify any of the individuals in the suit because a federal judge agreed with our application that they be permitted to sue anonymously because they had a well-founded fear of political persecution or retaliation by Israel, since many of them continue to reside in the occupied territories or their families do. So a federal judge agreed with us that we need not give their names to the world at this point because he believes that they have a well-founded fear of retaliation from Israel.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about another of the plaintiffs.
17-year-old boy from the Bronx who was working on his father's chicken farm, raising little chicks, and one day went out for a ride in a car.
Where?
Just outside of Ramallah once again during the second week of the invasion. Driving down the road again, no weapons, no resistance, no nothing. All of a sudden, a tank showed up around the corner and riddled the vehicle with 50 caliber machine gun fire, seriously injured. Took 7 hours to get what would normally be a 15-minute, at best, or at worst, rather, car ride to the hospital. He was dragged out of the ambulance, stripped naked, made to lay on the ground in the sun for 2 hours, lost important parts of his body, is in just terrible shape. His crime, he's Palestinian, U.S. citizen.
Did the State Department raise any objections, or in the embassy? I mean, in the case of Sarita Saleh, whether you can identify her or not, we did a number of stories on that case when her father was pleading, calling the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem that he could go and get his daughter's body, which was in the morgue of the hospital.
The State Department
in the
has
lot.
Not only done nothing in any of these cases, they've served as an obstructionist entity which has permitted Israel to unleash a reign of terror. In the case of two of our plaintiffs who were torture victims, the State Department's known about it for several years. Never charged, held illegally for weeks, tortured. State Department knew and did nothing. In fact, the State Department's told almost all of our plaintiffs, there's nothing we can do when it comes to Israel. We essentially are powerless to stop them.
Is the State Department, is George Bush powerless?
Well, George Bush can do what Nancy Reagan said many years ago, just say no. The fact of the matter is the Bush administration has allowed Israel to act with total freedom to do anything it wants. And the component of the suit that's directed at George Bush and Colin Powell is simple. In addition to the conspiracy component, the Arms Export Control Act, which is the mechanism that permits Israel to purchase weapons from the United States, requires by act of Congress that when there's an implication of human rights violations by a purchasing country, George Bush is obligated to send the issue to Congress and to give a report. He hasn't done it for 2 years. So the lawsuit will very shortly demand from a judge or ask a judge to order George Bush to do that. The perfect example is when George Bush told Ariel Sharon stop during the invasion, not once, not twice, but five times, and Ariel Sharon said no. And George Bush permitted him to use millions of dollars. Israel's received $139 billion from the United States since 1948, much of it going for weapons, much of it going for what they consider to be defense procedures, which really is arming this country to commit horrible crimes against Palestinians, and many of them are U.S. citizens.
We're talking to New York attorney Stanley Cohen, who has brought this unprecedented lawsuit against a number of different entities and people, including George Bush, Ariel Sharon, Colin Powell, arms manufacturers like Boeing and Textron and Bell Helicopter. How do you sue these companies?
It's simple. They're on notice. They have, in fact, retrofitted certain types of helicopters and certain types of tanks and APCs for urban warfare. They're not blind. They know what these weapons are being used for. They know what international law is, and they know what the Arms Export Control Act, which ultimately serves as the rules which protect that relationship. But yet they continue to sell these weapons, to provide these weapons, and then they blink and say, well, we're not responsible. Well, they are responsible. And we will shortly be asking a federal judge to void or at least freeze several outstanding contracts. The company that sold the F-16 to Israel yesterday is every bit as responsible for the war crime which was carried out yesterday as the pilot, as Ariel Sharon, and ultimately as George Bush.
You also talk about a group, the Christ Lutheran Church. Why them? Sued them.
Yeah, well, one of the most important, they're all important, the plaintiffs, obviously, but, you know, for years Israel has said the Geneva Convention does not apply to the occupied territories, namely the prohibition about the occupier putting its people in the occupied territories. They've claimed because Gaza is owned by Egypt and the West Bank is owned by Jordan. So they say we don't address the settlement issue because the Geneva Convention doesn't apply. Well, we have a plaintiff who's not just Palestinian, obviously, and a U.S. citizen, but a Jordanian citizen. So we're suing a particular settlement which took his land and is continuing to take his land. And this is a settlement that is working very closely with this particular church and several Jewish organizations in the United States. They raise money and provide money to this settlement. The settlement has used it to purchase weapons that they've used offensively, bulldozers that have destroyed homes, night vision and laser sights that have been used to burn people and to shoot at people. So they've got to understand that while it may be romantic to involve themselves in funding the settlements in the deserts of Palestine, they too are ultimately responsible for the acts of their agents, in this case the settlements, which continue to be illegal and which continue to perpetrate tremendous harms against civilians in Palestine.
The One Israel Fund?
Oh, absolutely.
What is it?
The One Israel Fund is a collective. It's a group. It's a not-for-profit. It's interesting. There are a lot of pro-Israel Jewish organizations in the United States which have tax-exempt status, which are not supposed to lobby. And they raise tremendous amounts of money to essentially pay for persons to go to settlements in what they call Judea or Samaria, to go to Palestine and to set up settlements. And again, these are groups that provide the money for settlements that are taking land, that are hurting persons, that are killing persons, and are committing war crimes. They, too, ultimately are responsible in a U.S. court and must be called to task.
Today in the headlines, the British government called the attack yesterday unacceptable and counterproductive, and British MPs, parliamentarians, condemned Britain for exporting arms to Israel, forced Foreign Secretary Jack Straw to admit British military equipment may have been used in the attack, he says he'll investigate. Have we seen anything equivalent here with Congress raising questions?
Well, no, that's exactly what this component of the lawsuit is, and we've had some discussions with various congressional representatives of the last several days, even before the attack. We plan on putting that question on the floor of Congress. And that's, again, through the Arms Export Control Act, because ultimately it's Congress that has to oversee the use of weapons that are exported and sold, not the president. Ultimately, the Arms Export Control Act has only one oversight committee, and that's Congress. We haven't seen their involvement yet because Congress has pretty much served as a rubber stamp for Israel. Sharon mimics George Bush. They must use the same PR firms. They wear the flags in the right way and their lapels, and they say the right things. And that tends to convert into Congress not wanting to get involved, but I think that's going to change.
What about immunity? I mean, was what you're doing really purely symbolic?
Not at all. I would be the first to concede that Ariel Sharon has essentially sovereign immunity for what's occurred during the last 2 years. He does not have sovereign immunity for Sabra Shatila. He was not the head of state.
And explain for people who don't know Sabra
1982, Israel invaded Lebanon with 60,000 troops and hundreds of tanks and hundreds of airplanes, purportedly to set up a wider safety net in response to an attack upon one of its ambassadors in London. They entered into a civil war. At the end of the day, they controlled all of Lebanon. There was a peace treaty brokered with the PLO. Thousands of PLO fighters left the camps in the west side of Beirut in Lebanon, mostly Sabra and Shatila being the largest camps, leaving tens of thousands of defenseless older men and women and children and the invalid and the handicapped in the camps. The Falangists, who served as the army at the behest of Israel, entered the camp over a 40-hour period, during which time Israelis provided ground support, sealed the camp, provided helicopter support and rockets. And at the end of the day, thousands of Palestinians were raped, killed, tortured, and disappeared. Ariel Sharon was held responsible by the Knesset. He was then the defense minister of the army and was driven from office. He does not have sovereign immunity for that, nor do the other players in this lawsuit have sovereign immunity for acts which have occurred during the Intifada. They act as if they do simply because no one in the past has tried in the United States to bring them to task. This case changes that.
Didn't parliamentarians, Knesset members, just move to seek immunity?
Well, they did. It's interesting. As a matter of fact, it actually strengthens our argument because one of the core arguments we have is Palestinians can't get justice in the Israeli courts. And in fact, as a matter of law, it really doesn't matter because, number one, it doesn't apply to U.S. law. And number two, Palestinians can't sue or get justice in Israeli courts even without this new act of immunity, which we think is sort of a knee-jerk response to their concern about the new war crimes tribunal and the lawsuit, which they knew was coming in the United States.
Amnesty International just declared Palestine's suicide bombings as crimes against humanity. What about the issue of saying that these are acts of war, that they're engaged in war?
If you're talking about the acts on the ground, the whole world is pointing a finger at Hamas and Al-Aqsa and Jihad and other groups, and their silence speaks volumes when it comes to the issue of state terror. It does little for me, especially as a Western male, to add to the debate over whether what Hamas does or does not do is a war crime or is not. I find it interesting that at the one hand, Amnesty International has decried what Israel's done for years, described them as war criminals almost daily, and Israel rejects them as sophomoric and interlopers, basically. But when they do describe acts of Hamas as war crimes, all of a sudden they become great heroes. This suit is about U.S. citizens injured on the ground by Israel at the behest of and with the support of the United States and various organizations in the United States. It's interesting that while George Bush is prepared to go to war to protect U.S. civilians all over the world, the one group of U.S. civilians he's forgotten about is Palestinians, and there are 45,000 of them in the West Bank and Gaza.
What has been the response to this unprecedented lawsuit you filed? Have you yourself, Stanley Cohen, been called anti-Semitic?
Oh, yeah, it's self-hating Jew. No, if you're Jewish and you attack Israel, you're self-hating. If you're Christian or non-Jewish and you attack Israel, you're anti-Semitic. You know, Israel's gotten a free ride for 50 years. They're the only country in the world that's above reproach. And when any of us, especially Jews, challenge it, all of a sudden we're criminals. Sure, there's been a lot of publicity, a lot of good publicity, a lot of it's interesting. There's been tremendous response in the media throughout the world, very little by the mainstream media in the United States, and I don't believe that's mere happenstance. We know there's a connection between the mainstream media in the United States and what Israel's been doing in Palestine for five decades.
And what is your own personal story in terms of where you come from, your own family history, and also those that you represent?
Working class family from New York, just outside of New York City, a public defender for 7 years, doing private litigation for about 12 years, successfully represented Musa Abu Marzouk, the head of Hamas, the political wing when Israel tried to extradite him in the mid-90s, represented a lot of squatters, represented Lynn Stewart. On a personal note, you know, this so-called self-hating Jew comes from families that lost people in the Holocaust and also lost a cousin in a bus bombing in the mid-90s in Israel.
You're saying you did.
Yeah, myself personally. And if nothing else, that's what drives me in these types of cases, that while so many Jews are quick to say never again and recall the memories of the Holocaust and what's happened to Jews traditionally or often, they seem to be silent when it comes to what Jews or what Israelis are doing, what Israel is doing to Palestinians. And my position is I will not sit back silently while the world watches this genocide being perpetrated against Palestinians with not just Israel, but the United States and corporate military groups in the country.
Attorney Stanley Cohen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Surrounded by the army. Airplanes in the sky. Everybody knows someone who had to die. Oh, Palestine, there's a hole in your soul. Oh, Palestine, or will it ever be whole? Talk about the settlers. Come from so far away. Talk about the money from the USA. Talk about the bullets made of plastic and steel. Pictures of a Palestine underneath the Iron Heel.
O Palestine, Jim Page, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration announced Monday it's withdrawing $34 million from the UN Population Fund. The fund provides family planning and reproductive health services in 142 countries. According to the UNFPA, the funds would have prevented 2 million unwanted pregnancies, more than 77,000 infant and child deaths. The United States is the only country ever to deny funding to the UN FPA for non-budgetary reasons. The Bush administration claims it provides aid to the Chinese government agencies that force women to have abortions. This in spite of a recent State Department fact-finding mission, which concluded there's no evidence that the program knowingly supports coercive abortion programs. The administration doesn't need to look as far as China for evidence of coercive reproductive policies, forced sterilization, forced foster care, and child exclusion policies. Today, we're going to talk to a legal scholar and social critic who traces a direct line between the eugenics movement, the forced sterilization of black women, and the way the current welfare laws in the country attempt to coerce poor women into having few or no children at all. But we're going to start with Sterling Scruggs, who is spokesperson for the United Nations Population Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to the U.S. cutting off UNFPA funds?
Well, as I've said to other people, we're shocked and bewildered because we're not involved in coercion and never have been anywhere in the world. And in fact, our whole program in China is to try to bring China into line with international human rights standards. And we promote that same thing, human rights and particularly women's rights, all over the world. So it's just the opposite.
Can you talk about what this cutoff will mean?
Well, $34 million, as you indicated earlier, would prevent a lot of unwanted pregnancies, about 800,000 abortions, maternal deaths, child deaths, untold numbers of new AIDS infections that could have been prevented. It will be pretty devastating. And in countries all over the world where our reps now are working with the government to decide what part of the programs to cut, some of the examples we've given is a new AIDS clinic for youth in Haiti where they can get information, the ABCs of AIDS. First, abstinence, if you have one partner, or use condoms, and use condoms anyway. In Burundi, emergency obstetrical care, because one woman dies every minute from pregnancy-related causes, and 75% to 80% of that could be prevented around the world with very simple interventions, such as family planning, such as emergency obstetric care. So that's what's going to be affected in all the countries where we work.
Secretary of State General Colin Powell praised the Population Fund last year. So what's happened?
Good question. The team went to China and they found, as two other teams have found, that UNFPA is not involved in coercion. In fact, the person who introduced the legislation based on quote-unquote research from a small ideological group in Virginia who wrote this stuff about China.
Which group is this?
PR, Population Research Institute. They've sent that around all over the world and attracted this person who says that I'm anti-family planning and so forth. In the UK, he was a member of a parliamentary team that went, and he came back and said, I've changed my mind about UNFPA. UNFPA is a force for good. All of the teams that have gone there have found that the same thing, and yet this decision is made. I guess it's guilt by association. And what I have to say to that is you can't change anyone's mind. You can't get any policies changed in any country without being engaged with the country and working with them.
Sterling Scruggs, spokesperson for the United Nations Population Fund. We turn now to Chicago, to Dorothy Roberts, who has written Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty. Her latest book is Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. First, your response to the U.S. cutoff of support for international family planning, Professor Roberts.
Well, I think it is the height of hypocrisy that the Bush administration is going to cut off support for a good family planning program in the name of preventing coerced abortions when the U.S. has long supported population control policies both abroad and in the United States. I think we should pay attention to the fact that in the United States, there are currently, in most states, family caps or child exclusion policies through welfare reform that deny to women on welfare the additional funds they would ordinarily get for when they have a baby. And this is deliberately to coerce women into refraining from having children. It's a deliberate attempt to reduce the birth rate among children on welfare. And in fact, although it's controversial what the actual impact is, at least one Rutgers University study tied the New Jersey family cap policy to an increase in abortion among black women in New Jersey. So right here in the United States, the official policy of the Bush administration reflected in state laws around the country, the whole point, one of the main points of welfare reform is to regulate the reproductive decisions of women on welfare. And it's actually not that different from what China does to get its citizens to only have one child. Most of it is through government funding policies like family caps. So I just think it's very hypocritical, and I think it's also important for people to recognize the difference between opposing the right to abortion and abortion funding, and that seems to be the catalyst for this, is the opposition to abortion and a kind of knee-jerk reaction to the impression that the UNFPA is supporting coerced abortion in China. But that's very different from opposing population control policies, policies that attempt to coercively regulate the reproductive decisions of groups of people, and in particular to get them to have fewer children. And those kinds of policies, population control policies, are very popular in the United States now and have been part of the U.S. policy toward developing countries. The idea that development is tied to reducing the populations in third world countries. So there's a lot of hypocrisy and contradiction, I think, in this pulling these funds from the UNFPA.
Dorothy Roberts is professor at Northwestern University School of Law. Yesterday, President Bush went on the air and launched a new federal adoption campaign as well, saying he was shoring up his image as a family man. What was your response to that announcement?
Well, again, this is one of those kinds of policies where you have to understand the politics behind it, and especially the race and class politics. Of course, it sounds wonderful to support adoption. Of course, we would all want children in need of adoptive homes to have them. But this is, again, part of a move in this country to deal with the problems of poor families, either by coercing them into having fewer children or by moving their children into adoptive homes. Where are these children that are being adopted coming from? This program that he's announcing has to do with the overload of children in foster care, children who've been removed from their homes primarily linked to poverty. These are not primarily kids who've been brutally abused in their homes. Most children in foster care are there because of neglect related to poverty, and a disproportionate number are Black. In fact, over half of the children waiting for adoption, these are children whose parental rights have been terminated, children in foster care. They're Black, even though Black children make up less than 20% of the children in this country. And what has been happening actually since this even began in the Clinton administration is a move to privatize the way that our society deals with the problems of poor children, especially poor minority children, to instead of figuring out how to reduce child poverty in this country, instead of generously supporting families, emphasizing moving those kids, you know, into nicer adoptive homes. And I think that progressive people in this country need to think carefully about what the significance of emphasizing adoption and link it to the same kind of private remedies that are being promoted for poverty, like family caps and like marriage for poor mothers, instead of having a policy, coming up with creative ways and generous ways to support families that are struggling to take care of their children.
Again, we are talking to Dorothy Roberts, who is a professor at Northwestern University School of Law, has written a number of books, her latest, Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. In the book that you wrote before that, mm-hmm. Killing the Black Body, yeah. Race, Reproduction, The Meaning of Liberty, on the one hand, you do support and the right of women to choose, of course, how they want to use their own bodies. But you tell a very interesting, different account than we usually get of the history of reproductive rights in this country, particularly when it comes to African Americans and what rights women have had over their own reproduction. Can you talk about how birth control has been used to also oppress Black women?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that the women's movement in this country generally proclaims a message of increasing rights to women and control over their reproduction. Birth control is a liberating tool for women, and that really doesn't reflect the experience of Black women in this country. I think it's important to remember that the birth control movement led by Margaret Sanger in the 1920s and 30s was early linked to the eugenics movement, which was a based on the philosophy that society could be improved by encouraging those with the best genes to have more children and those with so-called defective genes to have fewer children. And so very early on, there was this idea of using birth control as a way of controlling populations, as a social tool. And of course, because of a belief that Blacks were inferior genetically and culturally and in other ways, and a long history of oppression, including slavery, Black people were victims of this. And so the very first publicly funded birth control clinics in this country were targeted at Blacks in the South. And then we went through decades of horrific sterilization abuse of Black women. We don't know how many, but it's probably numbers, you know, even maybe in the hundreds of thousands of Black women who were coercively sterilized and even sterilized against their will and against their without their knowledge. And this went on. It was revealed in the 1970s in a lawsuit called Ralph versus Weinberger involving two Alabama teenagers who were sterilized without their consent or their parents' consent, that this had been going on in federally funded welfare programs. And then you know, we can look at contemporary policies. At one point in the 90s, their cities were deliberately distributing Norplant to poor Black teenagers and making it difficult for them to get it removed when they wanted it removed. And as I
Norplant being the device that is implanted in a woman's arm.
Implanted, and you can't get it out without doing damage to yourself without a surgical procedure. And many women were finding that family planning clinics were pushing them to get Norplant, sometimes based on Medicaid policy and other kinds of directives from the public health department in the city or the state, and then they couldn't get anyone to remove it because in some states the Medicaid directed physicians that it would not pay for removal unless it was a medical necessity. And so, you know, talk about human rights violations. There were poor women in this country going around with an implant in their arm that they wanted out, that they couldn't get out, partly because of government policy. You know, so that's why I'm saying I think it's, you know, yes, we should challenge coercive birth control practices around the world, but let's not forget what's going on in this country. In my book, I call that a form of torture. I think that government policy was contributing to the torture of women based on this philosophy that poor women, especially poor women of color, should be having fewer children and that it was perfectly acceptable for the government to pushed that decision on them, whether they liked it or not.
On that note, I want to thank you for being with us. It's a conversation we're going to have to continue to have. Professor Dorothy Roberts, her books, Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty, and Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Michael Yeh, Anthony Reparation Sloan, our engineer, and music maestro Wendy Patterson helped today. Our website is democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
How long shall they kill our brother?